Welcome, and thank you all for standing by. Participants will be in a listen-only mode until the question-and-answer session of today's conference call. At that point, if you would like to ask a question, please dial star and then one. This call is being recorded. If you have any objections, you may disconnect at this point. Now I'll turn the meeting over to your host, Trish Gorda. Ma'am, you may begin.
Thank you, Haley. Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to today's webinar. My name is Trish Gorda, one of the organizers for today's call. Today's webcast is presented by the Illinois Department of Human Services, Division of Mental Health, and the Illinois Mental Health Collaborative. The title of today's webinar is DHS DMH Training for New Rule 132 Providers. I just wanted to mention that if you are having any trouble getting on to the webinar today, if you're being asked for a passcode, then that passcode is Illinois in all capital letters. The presenters today will be from the Division of Mental Health, Bureau of Community Services, Dr. Renee Mellinger, Deputy Clinical Director, Child and Adolescent Services, Dr. Mary Smith, Associate Director of Decision Support, Research and Evaluation, Leanne Reinert, Clinical Policy Specialist, and from the Collaborative, Sue Kappas, Clinical Quality Assurance Advisor, Brent Sparlin, Clinical Care Manager Team Lead, and myself, Trish Gorda, Business Systems Analyst too. Today's training will cover the following topics: billing requirements and registration, the authorization process, service matrix, consumer eligibility, reimbursement and submission of claims to HFS, resolving claims issues, and provider enrollment and provider databases. We will take a short break at about the halfway point. Before we begin the formal presentation, I would like to review with everyone a few housekeeping items. If you happen to get disconnected from the audio portion, please call back into the same number that you just dialed, which is 1-888-324-0279, and the passcode is Illinois. The visual portion of this presentation is web-based. Of course, you can choose the audio portion only, but if you would like to see the webinar PowerPoint presentation, the login information is located in the invite you received after you registered. And of course, if you are asked for a passcode when you log into the webinar, that passcode is Illinois in all caps. If you are experiencing any problems with that particular link to join, you can also go to www.joinwebinar.com and enter the webinar ID directly, which is 560-905-722. There will be a designated question and answer portion at the end of today's presentation. The operator will open up the lines for questions at that time. Lastly, at the conclusion of the presentation today, we ask that you please complete the brief satisfaction survey that will appear when you close out of the online forum. It should take less than 5 minutes to complete the survey, and we value your feedback. I will now turn the call over to Dr. Renee Mellinger from DMH.
Yes, good afternoon, everyone. I am Renee Mellinger. I'm a child and adolescent psychiatrist, and I am the clinical director for Child and Adolescent Services. So it's not confusing for people. This presentation is a little bit out of place. I was unable to join in yesterday, so I believe this will be the one clinical presentation that you'll have during this webinar, followed by technical assistance and advice. So if everyone is looking at the first slide, what I'd like to say is that there are 30 slides in the slide box. Because of limitations in time, we thought that it would be a good idea to give you as much detail as possible on the 30 slides, but with 10 minutes, I'm not going to be able to go through each one. So what I'm going to do instead is to go through the slides probably fairly quickly and try and give you an overview of what child and adolescent mental health services provides that hopefully will assist you in your provision of services to children and adolescents. The first slide has outcome measures, and just to let you know that sprinkled throughout the next 30 slides are contact people for different parts of child and adolescent, people that you may need to contact. Yolanda Linares would be the contact person for any questions you have regarding outcome measures. And as I said, there'll be the people who are heads over each of these different areas will be listed, as well as websites that will be helpful for you. The next slide basically describes what the outcome analysis system is. And it's basically a web-based data system that we call DATSTAT. And it will allow you to track treatment responses by individual clients. It allows provider agencies to track clinical outcomes per clinical provider, service, per region, gender, ethnicity, and others. The outcome instruments that are used that you'll become very familiar with are the Columbia Impairment Scale, the Ohio Scale, the Goal Attainment Scale, and lastly, the DECA, which is for early childhood assessments. With DATSTAT, as you're seeing kids, there'll be ways that you can introduce this information, and we'll be able to track a lot of information about how the progress of the kids. The resource link that you can also get to in DATSTAT is called Project Educare, and additionally, PracticeWise. Project Educare is a web-based learning system for provider and families. It includes links to other mental health websites. It's really a wealth of information. There's a link when you go to Project Educare, you can link into the Journal of Clinical Child and Adolescent Psychology. You can get free CUs for licensed clinicians. So there's just a wealth of information. And in your abundant free time, if you just have a chance to go in and play around and kind of see what all of this, what all the different features that there are, I think you'll find they're very valuable. Project Educare will also give you information on how to use this particular site and how to access the different scales. To keep going, PracticeWise is a part of the entire DATSTAT system. And it offers tools and services to help the clinician and organizations improve the quality of care. Through this particular PracticeWise, there are treatment materials. There are things that you can download that may be helpful in patient education, as well as user-friendly, both child and family-friendly information. And it will also give you, depending on the information that you input, it can give you information regarding the steps to care and inform you regarding treatment and treatment progress. I'll let you continue reading through Match ADTC. As I said, we don't have time to kind of go through each of these, but everything that you would need to know regarding the DATSTAT system, Project Educare, Match, will be right at, if you go through the slides, and you'll have easy access to these. We'll keep moving to the next slide, which is mental health in schools. Again, you have the contact information for our mental health in schools coordinator. I'd just like to say that, you know, with kids, you think about the community, you think about kids in school, and you think about kids in relationship with other children and their interactions. We consider school extremely important. We have a mental health and schools coordinator who is here to assist with any technical issues or problems that may come up regarding children and teachers and their interaction in the school environment. What you're seeing in front of you is the Illinois' interconnected systems model for school and mental health, and wanted to stress the things that are extremely important to us, which are universal prevention. That's tier one, and those are services for all kids. Tier two, early intervention. And tier three, which gets to your more intensive intervention. So we like to think of treatment of kids and how kids relate in different environments in a developmental framework. And we like to see continuum of services that extend from early intervention and prevention all the way to the top tier interventions, whether it's in the context of the mental health system or the school system. You can read through this. It basically talks about what a school-based mental health system should be like. We'll go on. I want to mention that we do have collaboration with six community mental health providers that have partnered with 15 schools to implement this Illinois Interconnected Systems of School-Based Mental Health. The other area that CNA covers, I think most of you are probably familiar with SAS services, Screening, Assessment, and Support Services. Roberta Allen, licensed clinical social worker, is the contact at our child and adolescent office for any questions that you may have about SAS. The probably the most important thing to know is that as siloed out as many of the systems in mental health and just across in any type of a state system, SAS is one that is actually a multi-department crisis intervention program, so the DMH, HFS, and DCFS all communicate regarding groups of kids who are and work together on programmatic issues, treatment issues for groups of kids who may be in crisis and require psychiatric hospitalization. There is a process for SAS. Probably many of you are very familiar with it, but again, for any child who's in crisis, there is a CARES line that can be called. The number is here before you. At that point, a screening is done, and if it reaches the level of the child needing possible hospitalization, SAS is contacted and will go to the child, wherever the child may be, to make the assessment of whether or not to proceed with the hospitalization. If the child does not reach that level, SAS does get involved for follow-up for a period of 90 days or longer, depending on the circumstances. So the important number, the CARES line, is here. That's the first line. They do a screening and followed by a SAS intervention. The next slide describes who is eligible and what the services are. Excuse me. The other thing I think that's important is the Child and Adolescent Services really subscribes to system of care principles, guidelines, and values. We highly value families, youth. We want culturally sensitive care, trauma-informed care, and certainly we try to bring things to best practices and use evidence-informed treatment whenever possible. Just wanted this slide to stress basically how important it is that we all work together. There are families, the FRD, Family Resource Developers, are in some of our provider sites, and they are critical in working with the parents, and they are part of the entire SAS program. The next slide is Family Consumer Specialists. These are individuals that work with child and adolescent. We have five, one in each region. You're looking at a map of the map that DMH uses of the state, and we have the five regions with, you can look at the colors, basically orange, yellow, blue, purple, and green. We do have a family consumer specialist, which is an individual, a parent, who has lived experience with mental health issues by virtue of a child or a close relative. They are experts in knowing how to navigate the system and making connections and spend time on working. They work with the family resource developers as well as directly with CNA staff. Again, a description of what the family consumer specialists do on the next slide. Want to mention that the Family Consumer Specialists do host the Parent Empowerment Call. That's every month. Usually the time is 12 to 1, and there's a 1-800 number there. It is for parents. There's usually some topic that's very pertinent around mental health that's discussed over the hour of the call. And the information, that phone number, and may be helpful to you in terms of helping some of the parents or even the kids that you're working with. The Family Consumer Specialists also do monthly trainings for the family resource developers and other parent peers. And they have developed a CFPP or Certified Family Partnership Professional credential. And again, we're trying to try and standardize the types of certifications and the type of provision of services, you know, across all of the family consumer specialists and people who are providing care for kids. This is one. If you want more information, any of the numbers of a family consumer specialist, you can call for that. At our child and adolescent office, which is on the campus of Reed Mental Health Center, we're called the Annex because we're a little building in the back. I just wanted to let you know that in addition to the others that I've mentioned, there is a client assistance program at Child and Adolescent. That number is 773-794-4895. Again, want to make sure you have that. Availability is Monday through Friday from 8:30 to 5 o'clock. And this is a number that is a free phone assistance to aid consumers in locating appropriate mental health services in their community. So that during those times, we accept calls, and we have our expert staff here that will be able to help make connections and make links with community mental health services. I believe this is the last group of slides. I did want to mention that Child and Adolescent DMH is responsible for the services provided by the Individual Care Grant. The contact person is Kimberly Jenkins. You have her number there. The CARE grant provides a financial subsidy to assist parents or guardians to obtain residential treatment or intensive community-based mental health services. This is for youth who meet very specific criteria, including age criteria as well, but most importantly, they are youth who have an extremely serious emotional disorder, must have impairment and reality testing, which generally indicates a child who is psychotic and may be, schizophrenia might be an example of a child who might qualify for this type of grant. The number here is where the parent or guardian would call to request an application for an individual care grant. We work with the collaborative, who basically works to administrate the program. They are at this contact number and will send the application as well as provide the parent or guardian with the appropriate SAS coordinator that they should contact to assist with the application. I want to mention that for those of you who have worked as a provider for some time, we, in the last 6 or 7 months, we have been going through a process of transformational, as I'll call it, of the Individual Care Grant Program, where we are looking at revision to Rule 135, which really guides what you can and can't do with an individual, with the Individual Care Grant, so that we're really looking probably in the next 3 to 4 months to roll out a new look for the Individual Care Grant Program, and we'll be basically doing trainings and be in touch with providers regarding any changes. Currently, we're working under the same procedures and the same rule, but just to let you know, I think there's some things that are coming that will be of interest, and we'll be sure to keep you updated on what those things are. So that was a really quick tour of Child and Adolescent Mental Health Services. I think most importantly, I wanted to impart that we are here. You have our names and numbers to be able to contact us if you have any questions or if we can be of any help. I think the outcome measure part with Yolanda may be one that you might want to read through, look at the website, and if you have any questions, get on board with that, because you will be, as you see kids, as you're starting to see kids, you will be required to enter this type of information in. So I think with that, I am done.
Okay, Mary, did you want to say a few words?
Yes, I do. Thanks. Hi, I'm Mary Smith. I'm the Associate Director for Decision Support Research and Evaluation. And as such, I have responsibility for policy for management information systems for DMH, for reporting and data collection, and then again, evaluation and research. So what I'm going to do, you won't see any slides from me right now, what I'm going to do is give you a brief overview of the registration process, and then Trish Gorda with the collaborative will give you some more detailed information as well as a demonstration of how to submit a registration. But this is some critical policy information that you'll need. So the Division of Mental Health worked with the collaborative, which is our ASO, to develop an integrated management information system that's been in use since 2008. And so it integrates the provider database that Rich talked about yesterday. It integrates client or consumer eligibility information, as well as enrollment information, authorization, and claims information. All providers are required to be enrolled, and again, I know that Rich covered that yesterday, but one of the things that I want to emphasize is that you must always be sure that your provider information that you submit is exactly the same on the HFS database and the DMH and collaborative database. I can't emphasize that enough, because if they become out of sync, any claims that you submit will not be processed. You'll end up with errors, and then we'll have to get everything back in sync. So just a reminder there, although Rich may have covered that. So any consumer for whom DMH purchases services must be registered within a 90-day period. And we give you 90 days, even though, you know, it probably only takes less than 30 days to collect the information that's required for registration. But we give providers up to 90 days to submit a registration. The registration should be submitted as soon as possible. Keep in mind that unless an individual is registered, no claims can be submitted. This is critical, and it's critical now more than ever. You know, back in the old days, like prior to the SMART Act, any DMH provider had up to 1 year to submit claims, 1 year from the service date. However, with the passage of the SMART Act, providers only have 180 days to submit claims. So you can see, if you wait 90 days to register someone, you're going to really be in a crunch when you try to submit claims. So anyway, we always advocate that individuals be registered as soon as possible and that claims be submitted as soon as possible as well. Just in case you run into any problems, you'll have time to resolve those issues. The registrations are really based on data gathered during the assessment that you perform with individuals and their families. It consists of demographic information, descriptive information for individuals, clinical information. Dr. Mellinger talked about the Columbia and the Ohio scales, although you submit detailed information into the DATSTAT application, DMH does require that the global information for those scales be entered into the registration. We'll also be looking for information gathered during the application of the LOCUS, which you'll hear more about from Leanne Reinert if that wasn't covered yesterday. So, again, everyone for whom DMH purchases services must be registered. DMH also requires 6-month updates to maintain an individual's eligibility. Again, Trish will go into detail about how to do the re-registration. It's a brief re-registration, but we require the update of some key variables. One of the other things that I'd like to remind folks of is that registrations must be closed when a case is no longer active. We really don't want to have a bunch of open-ended cases in our system, you know, where folks have been inactive for many months. So please remember to close cases when they're no longer active. DMH expects any data that's submitted for the registration, as well as for any authorization or closings or, you know, whatever, to be accurate and to be complete. Again, Trish will walk through the registration process, and she'll also refer to a registration guide. It's really critical that the clinical folks and that the folks who are responsible for submitting data review that guide so that you know the appropriate responses that should be submitted. We use this information as a basis for planning, for federal reporting, for the block grant, because we also require data to be updated every 6 months. We're able to look at change in time based on some key variables. The other key thing to remember is that registration information is used as a basis for claims processing. And so, you know, this is another reason that we're looking for complete and accurate information. I know that the folks who are coming on board are billing for Medicaid services. You know, just a reminder, you can always check an individual's Medicaid eligibility through the HFS Medi system. And so if at any point in time you have doubt as to whether or not an individual is Medicaid eligible, be sure to check that system. One of the things that the Collaborative and DMH have done is to develop a series of registration reports. These are on-demand reports. They will be immensely useful to you because they help you track the status of a registration. They actually, you know, I don't know if you have your own systems or if you're using other systems, or if you would use Provider Connect, which again you'll learn more about. All of the data that you enter into the system for the registration is available through these reports. You can actually run them, dump them into an Excel file, and then you have all of the information that you've entered. And again, there are some reports that are helpful in terms of monitoring perhaps when a registration is active or inactive and when it's due to be resubmitted. So that is my overview. I'm going to turn this now over to Trish Gorda, who will walk you through the registration process. Trish?
Thank you, Dr. Smith. First of all, I just wanted to check, can everybody see my screen? It should have the title page, Provider Connect Overview. If so, I will go ahead and start. I'm going to give you an overview of Provider Connect. Provider Connect is a free, online, secure application. It is a portal into the Collaborative's MIS system and is accessed via the Collaborative website. Today, we will review how to access Provider Connect, how to register, re-register and close a consumer's case, and what resources are available. Several tools are available within Provider Connect. These include the ability to register a consumer, view a consumer's registration status, and close a registration. You can view authorizations, view and print authorization letters, access and print forms, and submit inquiries to customer service. benefits to using Provider Connect. Routine information can be easily accessed 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Provider Connect is accessed through the collaborative website at www.IllinoisMentalHealthCollaborative.com. It allows for multiple transactions to be completed in one session. Information may be viewed and printed, and calls for routine information are reduced. In order to access Provider Connect, you must be enrolled with the collaborative and HFS, and you must have a provider ID number assigned by Value Options. To obtain a provider ID number, contact National Networks at 800-397-1630. Each provider is allowed one Provider Connect logon ID. If more than one Provider Connect logon ID is needed, you will need to contact the Value Options EDI Help Desk at 888-247-9311 and press option 3. The Help Desk is available 7 a.m. to 5 p.m. Central Standard Time. Please note that there is a 48-hour turnaround time when requesting additional logins. Before you can access Provider Connect, you must first register as a user by taking the following steps. Go to the collaborative website and click on For Providers. This brings up the Provider Online Services page. Click Register and you will be taken to the Provider Online Services registration page. Complete all applicable fields. Note that all fields with a red asterisk are required fields. Please keep the following requirements in mind when creating your password. Passwords must be 8 to 20 characters in length, contain one number, 0 through 9, contain one uppercase letter, A through Z, and contain one of the special characters shown here. Also, your password can contain no spaces. Also note that passwords are case sensitive and expire every 90 days. This is an example of the Provider Online Services screen. And as you can see here, here is the option here to register as a user. Registering consumers is important as the information submitted during registration is used for enrollment of individuals for DMH purchased services to determine the eligibility group for which the consumer is qualified, which in turn determines what services DHS-DMH will reimburse. Before you can register a consumer, you must first obtain a consumer RIN or recipient identification number and DHS-SS or social services, also referred to as SDBO, from HFS. This is accomplished through the eRIN system, which can be accessed from the DHS website. Registration information will be updated within 5 business days. VO processes registration and assigns funds. VO sends fund information to HFS within 1 business day, and HFS processes the registration and send results to VO by the 2nd business day. There are several scenarios where you will need to access the registration screens. When registering a new consumer, when registering a new consumer and closing from services at the same time, for instance, if this was a crisis situation and the consumer did not return, when registering a consumer who had previously closed, when re-registering a consumer, which is required every 6 months to maintain eligibility for submission of claims, and when closing a registration of a consumer. When we begin the live demo, I will show you 2 methods for accessing the registration screens. The first is via the specific consumer search, and the second is by registering a consumer directly without first searching for a member. The collaborative highly recommends that you use the specific consumer search option for the following reasons. This option verifies that the consumer is on file with the collaborative. When you navigate to the register screens, after searching for the consumer, many of the demographic fields will have been pre-populated for you. Choosing to register a consumer link without first searching for the consumer will require all consumer demographic information to be entered before the system can determine if the consumer is on file. Before we begin the live demo to register a consumer, I'd like to point you to the Provider Connect Registration Guide, the June 2013 version, which is available on the collaborative website. Click for providers, then provider information link to the left. Then the document can be found in the registration section. Or you can access the guide directly by using the web address shown here. The Provider Connect guide provides an overview of the registration process and a detailed description of information required to complete the registration process. And now I'll begin a live demo to show you how to register a consumer. This is the Provider Connect login screen that appears when you select login from the Provider Online Services page of the collaborative website. Before I log in, though, I'd like to point out the contact information below the register button under the new user button. This is the number you'd use for assistance with any Provider Connect access issues. So now I will go ahead and log in. Enter our user ID and our password and click login. Try that one more time. Once you log in, the user agreement page will appear. Read through the agreement and then click I agree at the bottom of the page. So we'll scroll down, click on I agree. A brief pop-up will come up and just click OK here. And we come to the provider homepage. You will see links to the left of the screen and also in the middle of the screen. Many of the links that are available on the left-hand side are also available in the section under your message center. As I previously mentioned, the collaborative highly recommends that you use the specific consumer search method rather than just registering a consumer directly. So we'll go ahead and find a specific member that we want to register. And the two fields when searching for a consumer that are required are the consumer ID and the date of birth. And the date of birth needs to be in month, month, day, day, and the four-digit year, without any spaces or C slashes. We'll click search. And this brings you to the consumer demographic screen. Just real quickly, I wanted to note that besides the demographic tab, there are also tabs for enrollment history, COB, benefits, and additional information. To begin registering the consumer, first we're going to view consumer registrations that the consumer already has. To do that, we'll click the View Consumer Registrations button, and you may have to scroll down a bit to see the rest of the screen. If the consumer currently has no registrations with that agency, you'll see a message that says no records found. So we will click Add Consumer Registration. And this is the first screen of the registration process. Please note that all fields with an asterisk are required and must be populated. If you try to move on to the next screen without completing a required field, the field heading will turn red and an error message will appear at the top of the screen. So as you can see, some of the demographic information has actually been pre-populated in some of the fields. And the reason why you see the pre-population is because you searched for the member first. And so the system was able to verify that the consumer was already in the system and pre-populated some fields for you. You wouldn't see this pre-populating if you just registered a consumer outright. So the first required field is the registration start date. And keep in mind, this is the begin date for the 6-month registration period time. The registration date cannot be backdated more than 90 days, and it also cannot be a future date. The recipient ID, or RIN, is shown here, and it's been pre-populated. The client's ID is an optional unique ID number assigned by the agency to the consumer and is optional. The agency FEAN is the agency's 9-digit federal employer identification number and is also required. The satellite code is an optional numeric value between 0 and 99. The Medicaid site ID is the HFS-assigned Medicaid site ID number where the client is registered, and this is also a required field. The last name and first name have been pre-populated. Middle initial and suffix are optional. Date of birth has been pre-populated for you. The mother's maiden name. This is the legal maiden name of the consumer's mother. If this information is not known, then enter unknown in all capital letters. So I'm going to enter a name. Next is a Social Security number. As you can see here, it did pre-populate. However, if you may not know what the Social Security number is, you have two radio buttons for options. If the Social Security number is unknown, that radio button fills in all 9s in the field. Or if the consumer has no Social Security number, click that radio button and all 0s are entered. Since we know the Social Security number, we'll go ahead and leave that there. Gender has been pre-populated. The primary address has been pre-populated. Address to and suffix are not required fields. The county is also a required field, as well as township. There's also an option for Williams class consumer. Since our consumer is not a Williams class, we'll select no. If this consumer were a Williams class, then the IMD home code would also be required. So next is our household income. This is the total monthly income of all family members in the household at the time of registration, round to the nearest dollar. And just to let you know, all nines is not a valid household income. The range can go from all zeros to $99,998. Client income is also required. This is the total monthly income of the consumer at the time of the registration. The next field is household size. This is the total number of family members in the household, including the consumer. Household composition is also required. The qualifying exception indicates if the consumer has a qualifying exception that would allow registration without meeting income requirement. This is just an optional field that does not have to be completed. The education level is the highest grade that the consumer completed. Military status is required. If they are not, they don't have a military status, then you can just select not a veteran. Marital status is required. Employment status. The SSI-SSDI eligibility is required. And the DFI-CFI enrollment. I'm going to scroll down a little bit. The next required field is the court forensic treatment. Now we come to the race fields. There are actually five race fields that can be filled out. If there is only one race, indicate that in race one. And then for all the rest of the race fields, indicate nothing to report. Indicate our citizenship, Hispanic origin, language, whether or not interpreter services are needed, mental health residential arrangement, justice system involvement, DHS special projects. This is an optional field. There are also radio buttons for consumer third-party payer and mental health residential indicator. Scroll down a little bit more, and now we come to the special program enrollment section. If the consumer is to be enrolled in one of these special programs, you would select the Yes Radio button and then enter the begin date of that special program. However, our consumer will not have any special programs, so we do need to indicate no for all of the programs. And just a little bit of explanation on a few of these special programs. The Region 1 Crisis Care System, that is CHIPS. And CHP over here is Community Health and Prevention. The last section on this screen is the MH closing section. And you would only enter information into this section if you were closing the registration. So since we are just opening the registration, we will leave that blank. And click Next. And I see I have two error messages at the top of my screen. And this is just an example of what you'd see if maybe if a required field did not get filled out. So in addition to my red messages I have up here, I can scroll down and I can see in red which fields I've actually neglected to fill out. So this brings us to the funds sources available. This brings up all of the eligible funding sources. And we'll click Next here. And this brings us to the selected funding sources screen, which displays all of those eligible funding sources. Except it also includes the effective and expiration dates. And I just wanted to point out that it's not guaranteed that the consumer will be registered for any or all of these funds. At the very end of the registration process, you will be shown a screen and informed if the registration has been approved and the exact funds that have been assigned for the consumer. So we will click Continue to continue the registration process. And this brings us to the diagnosis screen. And you have a choice in the diagnosis code type of DSM or ICD. We're going to choose DSM. And all of the diagnosis codes, as you can see, there's three each for Access 1 and Access 2. All of these fields are required. So for our Diagnosis 1, Access 1, I'm going to choose one. And let me show you how I did that again. These highlighted blue field headings, when you click on them, that's a link to take you to a dialog box to choose the diagnosis that you need. So we can scroll down. And we'll just click on the diagnosis code. And then that automatically populates the code and the description. So we need to fill out the rest of the diagnosis codes. And if there isn't another diagnosis code, then we can just select the no diagnosis code. Same with the Access 2 diagnosis codes. scroll down a bit, and we come to the Axis 3 section. And these are more of the medical conditions. So at least one of these is required. I'm going to select my blood pressure. And I'm going to leave the other two diagnosis codes here blank because they're not required. The next field that's required is the principal diagnosis indicator. It allows us to select which one of these diagnoses in which axis is the primary. So since the only diagnosis code I have is axis 1, diagnosis code 1, that's the one I'm going to select. And then the last section on this screen is the first presentation assessment. And these are yes-no questions, but you do need to read them fairly carefully because they are kind of trick questions, but I'll read through them here. So the first one is, the primary diagnosis is reported in the registration and was obtained by a psychiatrist. So that we're going to indicate yes. The second question, the consumer does not have a history of autism, pervasive developmental disorder, mental retardation, or organic brain disease or trauma. And the question or the statement is that the consumer does not have a history. So we'll say yes to that as well. And the last question is the consumer has not had more than 16 weeks of antipsychotic medication treatment. So I'll say yes to this one as well. So then we click next to move on to the next screen. And this brings us to our functional scales. So the consumer that we're registering today is over the age of 18. So the system intuitively knows this and selects the correct functional scale to use. And because of that, these first fields here, the CGAS scores, which are only used for kids under 18, these do not need to be filled out for our consumer because our guy is over the age of 18. So we'll skip down to the GAF scores. And then we have some questions under the GAF regarding the first one is social group school. And you're going to select for each one of these serious impairment criteria met or not met. So for social group school, we'll say not met. For employment, we'll say not met. Financial, we'll say met. Community living, we'll say met. Supportive social, we'll say not met. Daily living, we'll say met. Inappropriate behavior, we'll say met. And previous functional impairment, it's also met. And then we come down to our LOCUS results. And for each one of these LOCUS scores, we need to enter a score from 1 to 5. So for risk of harm, I'll say 3. Functional status, 4. And while I'm doing this, keep an eye on the composite score down here, because this field is going to automatically calculate based on the scores you're selecting. Comorbidity. Recovery environmental stressors. Environmental support. recovery and treatment history, and acceptance and engagement. So we're all finished entering the scores, and we can see that our composite score is 23. The system has also pre-selected the locus recommended level of care based on the composite score. However, the assessor can recommend a level of care as well. The next section is the assessments section, and this also applies to kids under the age of 18. So we're going to leave it blank for our guy. And I'll click next. And we come to the history of illness screen. The first field is for continuous treatment. Continuous treatment of 6 months or more in one or combination of the following treatment modalities: inpatient treatment, day treatment, and partial hospitalization. So for each one of these, we're going to select consumer does not meet the treatment history criteria, or the consumer does meet the history criteria. So for continuous treatment, we'll say does not meet. Months of continuous residential in a residential treatment program, we'll say doesn't meet. The multiple residential is two or more admissions to inpatient treatment, day treatment, partial hospitalization, or residential treatment program within a 12-month period, and we'll say doesn't meet. Outpatient. This is the history of using the following outpatient services over a one-year period, whether continuously or intermittently, psychotropic medication, outreach and engagement services, including SAS and intensive community-based services. We'll say meets on this one. Previous treatment. In an outpatient modality and a history of at least one mental health psychiatric hospitalization. We'll say meets on this one. Our co-occurring disorder. This indicates if the consumer has been screened for co-occurring mental illness or substance abuse disorders. Say no. We also have radio buttons for evidence-based practice. We'll say no. Evidence-based practice support employment. And evidence-based practice medication algorithm. So when we're finished with these fields, we click next. And then we come to the mental health cross disabilities. And the required fields on this screen are the form completion date. We'll put today's date. The primary caregiver age. The type of service needed. And the type of service sought. And click next. The next screen is for guardian information. And since our guy is over the age of 18, these fields are not required. But I just wanted to point out the adoption indicator, that indicates if the consumer was adopted, and the guardian type, That describes the relationship of the guardian or responsible person to the consumer. We'll click next. So now we come to the consumer registration confirmation. We can see that the registration was approved, and we can see what funding sources the consumer now has as registration. So we have a button down here for return. And now I'm going to return to the PowerPoint presentation for a bit. And just to let you know that all of the screens that we went through in the live demo, we've also included in the PowerPoint presentation so that you kind of have a point of reference when you're doing this. Those are all of our registration screens. Now I'm going to speak a little bit about re-registering a consumer. Re-registration is used to update key fields in the registration to extend coverage every 6 months. It's used to update key fields and close the registration at the same time. An example would be if the previous registration on file for the consumer was past the six-month timeline, and at the time of the re-registering, the consumer was no longer receiving services. Re-registration is also used to update key fields and end date a special program. An example would be when a special program is being closed and the consumer needed to be re-registered for other funds. Now I'll go back to our demo. So now I'll walk through the steps to re-register a consumer. So as you can see, we're back at our consumer demographics screen. And in order to re-register a consumer, we'll again click the button to view our consumer registrations. And if you recall, before we started the registration process, there was a message saying that there were no registration records here. Now our registration list has been populated with all of the fund sources that the consumer was eligible for. Each registration line here, each fund can be re-registered. So basically, if it has a re-register button next to it, you can do the re-registration process for it. So we are going to click re-register for one of the funds. And this is going to bring up the current registration that we've already input into the system. As you can see, several of the fields have been pre-populated from the original registration. The ones that are needing to be entered, for instance, the registration date. And keep in mind that it is the start date of the registration. The re-registration process will require you to go all through the registration process just like we did the first time. However, any fields that need to be updated or changed for the re-registration should be done so. All of these fields that are pre-filled If they have changed, they can be corrected as needed. So when you're completed with this screen and are ready to move on, you would click the next button. That is a lengthy process, just like the first time we registered, so I'm not going to go all the way through it, but that is the start to the re-registration process. And just like before, we've included the screenshots in our PowerPoint that show you how to re-register a consumer. Now I'm going to talk a bit about closing consumer registration. Closed registration is used to, of course, close a consumer's registration. It's used to end date a special program. This will end the selected special program only. The consumer will still be registered for all of the other registered funds. Or you can use closed registration to both end date a special program and close the registration. This will end the special program on the end date specified and close the other registered funds on the closing date. If the special program is being ended on the same date that the registration is being closed, then both can be closed by entering the mental health closing date below the special programs. It is important that the consumer status be updated when he or she is no longer enrolled in special programs or when the consumer is no longer being seen for services. Now we'll go back to our live demo. So we are back at our consumer demographic screen, and the way that we would close out registration would be, again, to view the consumer registration, and then for whichever fund source we need to close, we would click Close Registration. And this screen, again, shows the registration record that is on file. And here we can see is our mental health closing date. If the mental health closing date is entered, then all fields from the mental health closing section to the bottom of the page are required to be filled out. If you are simply end dating a special program, and as we first registered this person, this consumer didn't have any special programs. But if they did, and one of these was selected yes, then you would put the end date right below the special program. If you are just end dating a special program, then that will just end that program only. However, the consumer would still be registered for the other funds. When closing a registration, at least one special program end date or the mental health closing date must be entered. So for either case, you would enter all the required fields and then click Submit. And we have our screens here. And when you click Submit and the closed registration is accepted, this is the screen that you're going to see that shows that the registration is closed. So that is it for the online registration piece. I wanted to next go over some customer support telephone numbers. This contact list is posted in the spotlight section of the collaborative website at Illinois Mental Health www.thechildrenscollaborative.com. There are contact numbers here for if you're having claims or billing issues, if you're having an issue with service authorization, if you have registration questions. This is a very helpful resource that you'll want to have on hand, have posted somewhere that everybody can see. Next, I wanted to talk about multiple RIN resolutions. You would call the collaborative at the number shown here and then select provider menu, press 1. A collaborative eligibility specialist will then work with DMH, and DMH directs the collaborative to keep or merge each RIN. I'd also like to talk about how to handle consumer name and date of birth changes. The consumer's name and date of birth that the collaborative has on file is the consumer's name and date of birth that the collaborative received from HFS. If the consumer's name or date of birth is incorrect, the correction needs to be made with HFS. Then HFS will notify the collaborative through the eligibility file that we get from them daily. Next, I'd like to talk about batch registration. To have a complete understanding of everything you'll need to know to successfully submit batch registration files, you will need to refer to the batch registration submission guide. That is found on the collaborative website. In the guide, you'll find information on obtaining a submitter ID and password, file specifications required for your batch file. You'll also find the batch file layout. And you'll also find information on error processing. So in the last demo, I showed you how to register an individual consumer using the online registration screens in Provider Connect. In this portion of the training, I'll show you how to submit multiple registration records on a specially formatted batch file using the batch registration submission process, also accessible in Provider Connect. The batch registration submission guide can be found on the collaborative website in the provider information section. So now we're going to walk through the batch registration submission process. From your provider homepage, you'll select EDI homepage on the left-hand side of the screen. From the EDI homepage, you can submit a new batch file, see the batch files you've previously submitted, and retrieve your response files. We'll get to response files in more detail in a few moments. But for now, we'll select the Submit Batch File button. In step one of the process, you're going to select the form type, which is always going to be Batch Reg, and then click the Next button. Step two of the process is information used to validate the batch file. However, for the form type of batch reg, there is no information to input, so we'll just click Next here. In step three, we'll click the Browse button and find and attach your batch file, and then click the Submit button. In step four, we see that our batch file was submitted successfully and that we'll receive an email shortly containing the submission number. So if you see this message. The message indicates that your batch file has been sent successfully. However, the file still needs to pass several file formatting checks. If any of these checks fail, your batch file will reject. In other words, just because you see this screen saying the file was submitted successfully and you received an email with a submission number, it does not mean that your batch file was accepted successfully. You must download the summary response file coinciding with the submission number to verify that your batch file was accepted. If the summary file shows that the batch file was rejected, you'll need to correct the batch file and resubmit. There are several reasons why your batch file may have been rejected. The batch file may not have been formatted correctly, or there could have been an issue with the trailer record. As I mentioned earlier, successful batch submission depends on meeting the file specifications and batch file layout found in the Batch Registration Submission Guide found on the Collaborative's website. The file will reject if it does not meet these specifications. So the Batch Registration Submission Guide is very important to keep on hand, especially when you first start submitting batch files, to make sure all the formatting is correct. So whether your file rejected or not, the next step now is to retrieve the response files. And this is a very, very important step. You can receive up to 3 response files for each batch file submitted. You will always receive a summary file, which will include whether which will indicate whether the batch file was accepted or rejected. If your batch file rejected, this is the only response file you will receive. The reason the batch file rejected will be shown on the file. If your batch file meets all file layouts and trailer record specifications, and your file contained registration records that were accepted, you'll receive an accepted file as well. If none of the records in your batch were accepted, you won't receive an accepted file. And finally, you may receive an error file, which contains all registration records that were rejected. If all the records in your batch were accepted, then you won't receive an error file. So if your batch meets all file layout and trailer record specifications, and some of the registration records were accepted, but some were rejected, then you will receive all 3 files, a summary file, an accepted file, and an error file. It is absolutely critical that you download these response files as soon as you receive them, to ensure that any rejected batch files or registration records are corrected as soon as possible and resubmitted. So to retrieve those response files, we'll start back at your provider homepage, and then we'll go back to the EDI homepage. You'll find your response files in the incoming file section. Our example here shows 3 files, so you can assume that you have a summary, an activity, and an error file. When you submitted your batch file, you were sent an email containing a batch submission number. Each type of response file has a different naming convention, and the batch submission number is incorporated within each file. It's kind of hard to see here on the screen, but all 3 of these files have the same submission number included in them. Refer to the Batch Registration Submission Guide for specifics on release file naming conventions. The first file that you're going to want to download is the summary file, which will tell you if your batch file was accepted or rejected. The summary file is the file that contains an R at the end of the file. And like I said, it's kind of hard to see here, but that's that top one. So you're going to click on that file, and you come to the View Incoming Files page, where you'll click on the file again. And then your file should have downloaded successfully. If it did download successfully, just click the Yes button, and you'll return to the EDI homepage in case you have more response files to download. If the response file did not download successfully, then click the No button, and you'll be taken to this screen where you can try to download the response file again using the EDI, or you can try downloading the file directly to your computer by right-clicking on the file name and selecting Save As. If you need assistance in submitting your batch file, contact the EDI Help Desk at the number shown here. And now I'm going to go ahead and turn the call over to Leanne Reiner.
Hello.
Hi, Leanne.
I'm here. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Are you giving me control of the camera, or does someone have my slides?
I'm doing that right now.
Okay.
And you should see a dialog box.
Yeah, I got it. I'm just pulling my slideshow up.
Great.
Thanks. Okay. Good afternoon, everyone. Trish, can you see my screen now?
Yes.
Okay, thanks. All right. I'm going to talk to you briefly about the DHS DMH policies related to both authorizations, utilization management, and then eligibility for various services that DMH funds. And again, my name is Leanne Reinert. I'm the Clinical Policy Specialist with Community Services here at the Division of Mental Health. Sorry, I'm going to be having some... Okay. Our utilization management program is how we ensure that the individuals for whom we are purchasing care are getting the services that are best suited to them and their recovery, that they are cost effective and provided in the most appropriate treatment setting and consistently with medical necessity and with evidence-based practices in those instances where the service that we are purchasing is an evidence-based practice. We implemented our utilization management program back in 2010 and have continued it since that time. And what we, our goal is to achieve balance between what a person needs, what their preferences are, the well-being of the person, the medical necessity, and the availability of the resources that the state of Illinois has to purchase care. We do not at any time limit medically necessary Medicaid services through our utilization management program, and we are fully compliant both with our Medicaid state plan as well as associated federal rules. There are three components to our utilization management program. These are the medical necessity guidance and criteria that we published, and it is part of our provider manual that you can access at the provider information webpage. We have some limited external authorizations required that I'm going to go through in a little more detail in a minute. And then we also do ongoing analysis related to the reporting of data on the various services that we purchase. Our medical necessity guidance and criteria manual includes the following services: assertive community treatment and community support team. These are both of our intensive team level services, as well as psychosocial rehabilitation, community support, and community support includes individual, group, and community support residential, and then therapy counseling. Some of those services have the ability to be billed for either adults or children, and we included separate criteria whenever that is the case. Again, you can find the criteria in full in the Medical Necessity Criterion Guidance Manual. We require that our providers use these to guide them in making consistent decisions related to the treatment of each individual they're serving, and they should use these criteria regardless of whether or not there's a utilization management program that's requiring authorization for the service or not, because in addition to applying these through our authorization processes, they are also subject to review when we come out to do post-payment reviews on claims for service. Okay, for our limited external authorization, the authorization for payment by either DMH or a designee is required for specific services, and we chose the services that the utilization management authorization would be required for based on an analysis of utilization patterns of the various services that we reimburse through our Medicaid funds. The thresholds that we use are the same for adults and children and adolescents. Again, they were calculated based on analysis by provider and consumer for the fiscal year. The authorization for payment for services beyond specified thresholds is, again, based on medical necessity criteria, and these authorizations will continue to be provided so long as it's demonstrated that the service is medically necessary. So this is just a little table that lets you know when authorizations are required. For our team services, assertive community treatment, or ACT, and community support team, we require authorization all of the time. So from the time that an individual enters services and needs a team service, those services are required to be authorized. For other services, psychosocial rehabilitation, community support group, and therapy counseling, we don't require authorization until the individual's services have hit a threshold that we've established based on data analysis. So for psychosocial rehabilitation and community support group, we combine those two services, and an individual can receive up to 800 units, which is a total of 200 hours, in any combination of PSR and CSG before an authorization is required. Once they hit that 800 units, if you've not sought an authorization and you continue to provide the service, you will not be able to bill for that service until you request and get an authorization, and any services that you would provide during a time when you had not yet sought that authorization but had exceeded the threshold, those services will not be reimbursed. So it's very important that you understand where the thresholds are and seek the authorizations when they're needed. For therapy counseling, we do not require authorization until an individual has received 40 units, which equals 10 hours of therapy counseling. And this is a combined individual, family, and group set of therapy counseling. And as I mentioned before, our third prong of our UM program is ongoing data reporting and analysis. So we look at utilization patterns, we look at post-payment review results, we study the impact of authorization, and then any other quantitative or qualitative aspects of service delivery. And we use these analyses to inform when we need to do technical assistance with providers, when we need to do training, and also to inform us as to if we need to modify our utilization management programs. All of our medical necessity criteria follow a format that starts with a diagnosis, then includes service initiation criteria, continuing service criteria, exclusion criteria, and service termination criteria. So you'll see that that common theme throughout the way that all the medical necessity criteria is written. As far as the diagnosis, first of all, we're looking for an eligible mental health diagnosis for which the proposed course of treatment has been determined to be effective. We're looking to see that the symptoms are consistent with the diagnosis that's been given, and that those symptoms that are being addressed don't have their primary origin in either an autism spectrum disorder, a substance-related disorder, or a principal diagnosis of mental retardation or intellectual disability. This does not mean that you are not able to serve someone that has a dual diagnosis of one of these disorders as well as a mental illness, but it does mean that your treatment plan and your recommended course of treatment is focused on the symptoms of the mental illness and not on the on the other diagnosis. Your service initiation criteria is to be considered for any individual that you're serving, not just individuals for whom you're seeking authorization. Again, it may be subject to post-payment review, and this is where you're going to establish the basis that the individual needs the service. Then the continuing service criteria, this is what you're going to utilize if you're going to request an ongoing authorization, if the individual has met the threshold and continues to need the service, or if they've met the threshold, you've gotten an authorization, and then you decide that you actually are going to need additional units of service, this is the criteria that you look at to determine whether or not to seek an authorization. This is how the collaborative clinical staff who actually do the authorization work for us, this is what they base their decision on. We also include in our medical necessity criteria some exclusion criteria, which of course would be reasons that the service would not be appropriate for the individual. If it is noted that the individual meets some of these exclusion criteria and then you provided the service anyway, that could be cited either in post-payment review or during the process of your authorization request. And then obviously termination criteria means the reasons why a service would be discontinued. And again, this could be cited as a reason not to authorize the request. And also, if we are doing a clinical practice guidance review, then the clinicians that are doing that review might call your attention to and be asking you why you had not yet terminated services if it appeared that the individual met the termination criteria. Okay, I'm going to go through the next set of slides pretty quickly. You will notice, even though I'm not going to read them to you, sometimes the information is verbatim from the manual, and other times it was paraphrased because some of it is redundant across services, and also because you don't need to hear me say the same things over and over for each service. However, you are strongly encouraged to review the entire medical necessity criterion guidance manual to be sure that you have a full understanding of the DMH requirements. So the first one, therapy counseling, you'll see that service initiation criteria, looking at the severity, complexity of symptoms, and level of functional impairment that require this service. The evidence would be, you'll see emotional disturbance and diagnosis that's destabilizing or distressing, that the individual's assessment identifies some specific mental health problems that could effectively be addressed through therapy counseling. And then we're looking for a locus score equating to a level of care of 2 or higher for adults. And then you'll also see that we include Ohio scales for the youth as well. Then if we're going to the continuing service criteria, so this is the criteria that you'd be looking at if you were going to seek an authorization for a threshold of 40 units or higher once that individual had received 10 hours or more of therapy, we're going to be looking for, is the individual actively participating in treatment? And is there significant benefit being had from this treatment? Is there documentation of that? And finally, that there's not a more effective and safe treatment available to the individual than the therapy counseling. Any time that a service has more than one modality, we'll have additional criteria specific to those modalities. For therapy counseling, there's individual, group, or family therapy counseling. And so each of those is going to look at whether or not that particular mode is the mode that's most appropriate. So if you're recommending individual, you'll need to demonstrate the necessity of one-to-one interventions. If you're recommending group, then, we're looking for the beneficial effect of the group. And finally, the family, then we're looking at, are there family dynamics that are involved with the individual? As far as exclusion criteria, if there's some cognitive impairment or developmental level that makes it unlikely the individual would benefit from the recommended course of therapy, then that would be an exclusion criteria. And, of course, if there's another modality that it appears would be more appropriate for addressing that primary issue, then that would also be an exclusion criteria. Service termination, if the goals that had been stated to be achieved in therapy have been reached, then that would be a reason for termination. If the majority of goals have been reached and there are other ways to reach the other goals that don't require therapy, then that would be a reason for termination. Or if the individual has shown no improvement at all, then that's an indication that therapy is not the most appropriate mode of treatment and further therapy would not be authorized in those cases. Okay, for psychosocial rehabilitation, this service is focused particularly on an individual's need to develop specific skills. And so we are looking for significant impaired role function in at least 2 areas. You'll see those listed. For this service, the locus level of care would have to be a 3 or higher. And we are looking for a transition or discharge plan for once PSR is no longer needed that is focused on the individual's increased integration back into their community and their ability to apply the skills that they were learning in PSR in those community settings. For continuing service criteria, we're looking for a treatment plan that's been modified if the skills have not yet been achieved. PSR is supposed to be a time-limited intervention, and so if an individual is getting to that 800 units, that takes about 90 days, and if the individual is getting to that point and has not yet acquired the skills, then we would be expecting to see some kind of modifications showing a different approach to them being able to develop those skills. Exclusion criteria, PSR is only for individuals over the age of 18. Again, PSR is something that if the individual's not participating, then we wouldn't be expecting you to continue to be putting it on a treatment plan and attempting to provide it if the individual's not wanting to participate. If the dysfunction or the skill that you're trying to address is actually related to intellectual disability or some type of organic process or syndrome, then those are not reasons for PSR. There may be other programs funded by other agencies within the state to address those, but that's not the intention of the mental health funds. And so those would be reasons that we would not be authorizing PSR. And if the individual already has sufficient skills, this is an intensive skill building program. If they've already got the skills, then we wouldn't be expecting you to be providing this particular service. And finally, on the other end of the spectrum, if PSR is not enough, if the person needs a more intensive contact than PSR, then that would also be an exclusion criteria. We would expect PSR to be terminated if the individual has learned their skills and requests termination or no longer needs that level of treatment. If it appears that they are at the point where they can now continue in a natural setting and don't actually need that more of a facility-based classroom-type setting, or if they're not making any progress at all, then again, you need to be looking at the treatment plan and making some modifications because our Rule 132 services are all rehabilitative in nature, and it's expected that the person's making progress. So if they're not, then probably a look at their current treatment plan and retooling that is what's needed. Okay, community support group. We're looking at significant impairment in the person's functioning and their inability to apply skills that they may have learned through their PSR program, their inability to generalize those to natural settings or to build or utilize the natural supports that could be available to them. Individuals that need community support group would be those that need the support of a small group to practice those skills in settings. And again, we're looking for very specific functional impairments that are going to be focused on in these community support groups. And the locus level of care recommendation here is for a 2 or higher. When we are looking at community support team services, the eligibility for both community support team and assertive community treatment are actually defined within Rule 132. So these next set of slides are taken right out of Rule 132. You'll see the 59 ILAC citation there. That's exactly where in the rule the eligibility criteria for community support team is listed. So we're looking at a Rule 132 eligible diagnosis. We're looking at an individual that needs a team of people to do outreach and support. And that it's expected that if they have that team of individuals that they will be able to benefit from the traditional array of community mental health and psychiatric services. And then we're looking for an individual who has tried and not benefited from less intensive community level of services. Then you'll see this very long list. There must be 3 or more of the following. You'll see things like frequent hospitalizations, crisis-related behaviors, detox services, There are some that are specific to children and family issues because we do have community support teams for children and adolescents as well as adults. So there's a whole list of possible choices here that, again, we need to see three of those in order for the person to be eligible for community support team. Again, because of the individual's symptoms, we're looking for evidence that there needs to be a team of people that are meeting the person's needs. So it's not enough that they are linked with a clinician who can provide those services, but they're really, they have a variety of needs and they need a variety of expertise working with them. Okay. For exclusion criteria, if the individual has sufficient skills that they don't really need the intensity of a team service, then they don't need community support team. If they are so impaired cognitively that they're not likely to be able to develop skills, then CST is not appropriate for them. Or if they need a more intensive service, such as assertive community treatment, which is more focused on outreach to individuals who fail to engage in services, then it would be recommended that you look to ACT instead of CST. Community support team should be terminated in lieu of community support individual, perhaps, or whatever services the individual may need once they no longer need the intensity of community support team, when they meet their treatment goals, if they've met most of them and it's possible to continue to assist them in meeting the remainder of their goals in a less intensive service, or if community support team is not meeting the needs of the individual and they need a more intensive level of care. Okay, assertive community treatment. This is an evidence-based practice, and individuals who have not been successful in maintaining gains in treatment with the traditional array of services that are available to the folks in community support team. So this service is specifically for those individuals that need outreach and engagement, that are not going to, on their own, keep appointments. They may need a lot of assertive intervention. And a lot of going to them. It is required that it's a full team of people that are providing those services. And because it's a team, it's an evidence-based practice, it was developed for specific diagnoses. So in order for an individual to be eligible for ACT, they have to have a diagnosis that's on this very abbreviated list. It's not our full Rule 132 diagnostic list. It is this very specific set of diagnoses that are required in order to be eligible for ACT. Again, not just someone giving them that diagnosis, but there has to be evidence that the symptoms that they are exhibiting are consistent with one of those diagnoses, and again, the symptoms cannot have their primary origin in autism, substance-related disorders, or a diagnosis of mental retardation. In order to initiate the service, there has to be an indication that the individual has agreed to the service. The individual, again, has to be 18 or older. This is an evidence-based practice for adults. And there has to be evidence that traditional services have not been effective for the individual. Again, ACT, just like CST, all of the eligibility criteria are spelled out in our rule. So you will see them here on this slide as well. We're looking, again, just similar to CST, we're looking at people who have had repeated and lengthy hospitalizations and use of crisis services and homelessness, perhaps some legal difficulties, and we're looking at continuous and severe functional deficits for these individuals. We're looking for at least one of the following, either severe difficulty in performing the range of daily living tasks that are necessary to maintain functioning as an adult in a community, or a severe difficulty achieving employment at a self-sustaining level, or even homemaker types of activities such as meals, laundry, budgeting, other types of general responsibilities within the home, as well as severe difficulty in achieving a safe living situation. So folks that repeatedly find themselves evicted or losing their housing, these are the types of folks for whom ACT was designed. For ACT, we're looking specifically for a locus level of care recommendation of 4. That is where ACT falls within the locus level of care recommendation. Again, we're looking for a treatment plan that includes goals, objectives, and a plan for when the person no longer needs ACT. So even though this is an assertive, intensive service for individuals who haven't had a lot of success with community mental health care, it is still expected that over time, they will be able to transition to other levels of less intensive care. So we are looking for that from the outset at authorization. Also, again, the need for team services, a team that includes a nurse, that includes a psychiatrist, that includes other clinicians with very specific skill sets. Is needed in order to show that the person needs ACT. Okay, I've given you some of the examples of continuing service criteria here. It's following the same theme that we've gone over before. We're looking for an impairment that's continuing despite the ACT service, but we're also looking for some progress in treatment. Perhaps it's that the person hasn't needed to be in the hospital since they started working with the ACT team. They may still have a lot of functional impairments, but they're able to live in the community. That would be evidence that they're making progress, but they continue to need the ACT service. So that's just one example. If the individual has sufficient skills that they could make progress without ACT, if they're not really in need of that assertive outreach component, then ACT would not be the appropriate service for them. If they are so severely cognitively impaired that they can't really work on developing skills, then ACT wouldn't be the appropriate service for them. If they need 24-hour supervision and support, such as in a residential program, then ACT would not be the appropriate service for them. Individuals should be discharged from ACT once they meet any of the following criteria. You'll see those listed on the slide and also in the medical necessity guidance manual. For ACT and CST, as I said earlier, all team services require authorization from the initiation of team services. So if an individual is demonstrating medical necessity for one of the team services, and you've completed an assessment and a treatment plan prior to making that authorization request, then you can get ACT authorized for up to a year at the point of requesting authorization, and you can get CST authorized for up to 6 months at the point of requesting the authorization. If, on the other hand, you've not yet been able to complete all of those documents, the assessment and the treatment plan, then the collaborative can authorize either of the team services for 3 months as opposed to the longer period of time. And in those 3 months, then you'll get your assessment, your treatment plan done, and you'll submit all of that, and then you can get the authorization for the year or the 6 months if you're demonstrating the medical necessity for that. For team services only, you can request backdating of the authorization. This is because, as I said, you have to have every service authorized. So the only way for you to complete your assessments and your treatment plans and to get engaged with the individuals in the team services, you may be doing some of that prior to having enough information to seek the authorization. So for these individuals only, you can request to backdate the authorization, but it's still there's a time frame required that you can only request it backdated up to 90 days. And you should still get the authorization completed as quickly as you can, again, because you want to make sure that you're going to meet the authorization requirements. You don't want to be providing the service only to find out that the person doesn't meet authorization requirements and then you can't bill for the service. For our other services, therapy counseling, community support group, and psychosocial rehabilitation, again, these are our threshold services, so you don't have to request authorization until they meet the threshold. Again, for therapy counseling, that's 10 hours or 40 units. If your LPHA deems that it's medically necessary, you can provide those first 10 hours or 40 units without any authorization. Once the individual is approaching that 10-hour, 40-unit mark for therapy counseling, though, you're going to need to request authorization to continue to bill us for that service. You should determine how many additional hours you believe are going to be needed, and that's what you should request at the time of the authorization. And that's also what the clinical care managers at the collaborative are going to be looking at, is whether or not the amount of additional hours you're recommending appear appropriate and supported by the medical necessity information that you've provided. PSR and CSG, again, 200 hours threshold combined before you need to request the authorization. So that first 200 hours is authorized solely based on your LPHA deeming that it's medically necessary. Once you're reaching that threshold, then you need to request an authorization through the collaborative, who is going to authorize additional hours based on what you've demonstrated to be medically necessary. Okay. The collaborative clinical care managers are going to review whatever is submitted for adherence to the medical necessity criteria that I reviewed and that you can review in more detail through the provider manual, as well as the Rule 132 requirements. If the medical necessity criteria are met, then the collaborative will enter the authorization. And in order for you to get reimbursed for the services provided past the initial thresholds, you have to submit the authorization and get it approved prior to providing additional services beyond the threshold. This means that you have to make your authorization request prior to either the authorization expiration date or the maximum number of hours or units that I've already stated at which time you meet the threshold. Okay. The collaborative does have an audit process where they randomly select a percentage of records that have been reviewed for authorization and request from the provider additional information of additional supporting documentation. And if you are notified that a particular record has been selected for this random audit, you must provide that information. If you don't provide that information, then the authorization will be ended for that individual. So you need to comply with that audit. We put this process in place instead of requiring the submission of a lot of documentation for every single authorization, and that's why it's very important that in order for us to continue that streamlined process of allowing the collaborative to authorize with less information the majority of the time, we have to have compliance with that audit process in order to continue to be able to do that. There's also an appeals process, which will be explained in detail when the collaborative does their actual walkthrough of how you get an authorization, but just letting you know that there is that appeals process available if they were to deny an authorization and you believe that medical necessity had been demonstrated. Okay, we're now going to switch over and we're going to talk about consumer eligibility. In order for DMH to reimburse care for an individual, there is both financial and clinical eligibility criteria that have to be met. Again, we describe all of these in great detail in the provider manual. The information that you give to us in the enrollment and registration process is how we determine which eligibility group an individual belongs in. And so all of that information that you just heard about an hour or so ago with the registration process, that's what we're looking at to determine eligibility. As far as the financial eligibility, we're looking at the individual's household income and size, and this determines the rate at which we will pay for services for individuals that don't have Medicaid. So so we're going to go on the next slide here. So eligibility group one, this is individuals who do have Medicaid, and in addition, they need services for either a mental disorder or a suspected mental disorder. They have to have a qualifying diagnosis as listed in our Rule 130 diagnosis code. Now, this is our larger, longer code list of diagnostic codes, not just the abbreviated one that we use for ACT. In order for DMH, for them to be eligible under the DMH Medicaid reimbursement, then they cannot be enrolled in HFS's integrated care plan or any type of managed care through Medicaid. If they're in one of those programs, then that program reimburses the services, and you can't bill DMH for any of the services provided. You have to enroll and register them with DHS-DMH, and they have to be found to be currently eligible under the Medicaid program. Now, we also have three other eligibility groups in DMH, and this is for individuals that do not have Medicaid but do have a need for mental health care and meet certain financial criteria. In order to bill us, bill DMH for one of these eligibility groups, you actually have to have a contract with us to do that. So it's separate from the Medicaid billing. I can go through this pretty quickly because mainly what we're targeting today is the new Medicaid providers. But just so that you are aware of it, in case any of you out there are going to have this type of contract with us. The first one is our non-Medicaid target population. These are individuals who do have, for adults, serious mental illness, for kids, serious emotional disturbance, but they don't have Medicaid. Again, you have to show that the person has some type of mental disorder. They have to be enrolled and registered with us and have a RIN. You have to do the household income and size. And then there's specific diagnostic functioning level and treatment history criteria for these individuals. For 18 and older, we're looking at a serious mental illness. We're looking at significant functional impairment. And we have a smaller list of diagnoses for adults than our broader one for the eligibility group one. We also are looking for treatment history that, again, shows a length of time that the individual has needed treatment and some functional impairments across areas including social, occupational, problems with their families, that type of thing. An individual can also be eligible through Group 2 if they are currently receiving treatment, and because they're currently receiving treatment, maybe their functional impairments have improved, but there is some history of that functional impairment prior to receiving the treatment. And then for children, we're talking about those under the age of 18. We're looking for serious emotional disturbance. And then, again, we have a list of diagnoses. It's slightly different than the list for adults, you'll see. And then, again, a treatment history and functional criteria that the kids must meet. Okay. For eligibility group 3, we call this our non-Medicaid first presentation of psychosis. This functional group, or this group, eligibility group, is aimed at individuals who have very recently experienced the onset of psychotic symptoms, and maybe because it's recent, they haven't yet qualified for benefits. Now, with the introduction of ACA and expanded Medicaid eligibility, there will probably be less of a need for this eligibility group than there has been in the past. But the purpose of this group was to provide services to those individuals that were later on in the course of their illness would likely already have Medicaid and would be meeting our eligibility group one. We're trying to provide them services earlier, intervene earlier, and hopefully intervene in such a way that maybe their course of illness does not result in as much impairment as it would if they had to endure a period of time without treatment. So again, you'll see this is very specific diagnoses. We're looking at a very specific age group, and again, this diagnosis has to have been given by a psychiatrist. So while Rule 132 allows any of the LPHAs to do a diagnosis for this particular DMH eligibility group, the diagnosis has to have been done by a psychiatrist who's actually evaluated the individual. Also, because we're looking for individuals who are in their onset of psychosis, we're looking for very minimal treatment, 16 weeks or less of medications. Again, no history of autism, pervasive developmental disorder, mental retardation, or organic brain issues that are the primary reason for the services they're in need of. And finally, eligibility group 4. This is what we used to call our eligible population as opposed to our target population. This is a broader range of diagnoses and and less requirements for functional impairments. The difference here is that the service package that's available to these folks is much more limited than the service packages that are available to the folks in the other service groups. But this does allow DMH to provide at least crisis-level funding for individuals who are in need of some immediate mental health care and meet specific financial criteria as well. So, again, this is our larger list of diagnoses. We're looking for some significant impairment, and, again, that financial criteria of less than 400% of the federal poverty level is required in order to be funded through Group 4. Our service benefit packages for Group 1, that's the Medicaid folks, they can have any medically necessary Rule 132 service. For our non-Medicaid target and the non-Medicaid first presentation folks, they can have unlimited crisis intervention and then limited amounts of mental health assessment, case management, psychotropic medication. And Group 4, the non-Medicaid eligible folks, can have unlimited crisis intervention as long as that's needed and some mental health assessment to try to determine what other resources might be available to them outside of what DMH has funds to purchase. Okay, that is the end of my presentation. So, Trish, am I turning it back over to you?
Yep, go ahead and turn it back over to me, Leanne. And we will now turn the call over to the clinical team.
Thanks, Trish. Hello, everyone. My name is Sue Kappas. I'm the Clinical Quality Assurance Advisor at the Illinois Mental Health Collaborative, and I am going to focus on ACT and CST, the process of submitting a request through Provider Connect. DMH requires the collaborative to respond to requests for ACT and CST authorizations within specific timeframes. ACT and CST requests, for both of those, the expected turnaround time is within one business day of receipt of a complete initial authorization and 3 business days for a complete reauthorization or concurrent request. For therapy counseling, CSG and PSR, the turnaround time is within 7 business days of receipt of a complete authorization request, all excluding holidays and weekends. A provider can submit an ACT or a CST authorization request online at the Illinois Mental Health Collaborative or by secure fax to the number on the slide there, 866-928-7177. To request an initial auth for a consumer for ACT or CST, the treating provider will need to submit an authorization packet. And this packet includes either an ACT authorization request form, and on that form it will ask for the locus information for adults, or if you're submitting for CST, you'll need to include a CST authorization request form. And that form will ask for either the locus information or the Ohio scale, depending on the age of the person that you're requesting the service for. The package should also include the initial treatment plan with ACT or CST listed as a service, the consumer's initial crisis plan, and a mental health assessment. So once the initial ACT request is submitted, the documents are reviewed for adherence to the clinical criteria based on service definitions, Rule 132, and the authorization treatment guidelines. If the clinical criteria are met for the service, the collaborative clinician will enter an initial authorization for 90 days. Leanne talked a little bit about this in her presentation. Let's say, for example, an MHA is submitted, then the clinician would authorize 90 days. If a treatment plan is submitted at the time of the initial, the clinician would authorize 12 months of service. And for the CST authorization, if a provider submits a treatment plan, the clinician can authorize for 6 months and again, only 90 days, for example, if an MHA was submitted. Before the initial auth expires, the ACT and the CST team is to submit a reauthorization request if the consumer continues to require ACT or CST. This request should be submitted within 14 calendar days of the initial authorization expiration date. To request a reauthorization for a consumer, the treating provider will submit a complete request for authorization of ACT and CST, and essentially it's going to include the same forms that we just talked about, the authorization request form, either for ACT or CST, an updated treatment plan, and the crisis plan. Once the request for reauth of ACT or CST services is submitted, the documents are again reviewed, and if the clinical criteria are met for service, the collaborative will enter an authorization for either 9 months or 12 months, and for CST, a 6-month authorization will be entered by a clinician. And once again, before the reauth expires, the ACT and CST team is to submit a reauth request within 14 calendar days prior to the auth expiration date. The next two screens are examples of the request for authorization for ACT form and request for authorization for CST form, which can be found on the Illinois Mental Health Collaborative's website under Provider Manual. This next section focuses on how to submit an ACT request through Provider Connect. You will log into Provider Connect. You can enter an authorization request by using either link, the one on the left-hand side or the one in the middle of the page. This will bring you to the disclaimer page. Select Next. We'll do your member search, enter the required fields. You'll need the consumer ID, which is the RIN, the date of birth. Select Search. Bring it to the member demographics page. Make sure you are working with the correct consumer. Select Next. Select your agency's address. And that next page will bring you to the Request for Services page. You'll enter the requested start date for ACT, the type of services, mental health, the level of care would be assertive community treatment, level of services, outpatient. You can attach any supporting documents in this section for the web-based request. This is where you would attach your MHA, your treatment plan, your crisis plan, the request forms, and select Next. We'll complete the clinical staff contact information, name and phone number, fax number. On the next screen, you will check all that apply under service definition criteria. And below that, there is a section for acute inpatient episodes in the prior 12 months. You will list any hospitalizations and the dates of service. The next screen is the diagnosis screen. All fields with an asterisk are required. If there is no diagnosis code, you can use the V code. Check all that apply. Again, all 5 axes do need to be filled out. The current GAF score is pre-populated from your registration. You'll need to enter the highest GAF score in the past year. the next page is the locus screen, and that will also pre-populate from your updated registration. And as Leanne said in her presentation, we're looking for level 4. There is a narrative box there where it does hold 200 characters. You can explain a deviation. The next screen is the psychotropic medication screen. List medication information. There's a drop down there for the type of medication. You'll need to put in the dosage, frequency. There's a drop down for the frequency. Who prescribes the medication? And that will take you to the determination status page, where it shows at the bottom printing and download options. You can print the authorization results, you can print the request, you can download the authorization request, or you can return to the home page. Providers must notify the collaborative when a consumer is discontinuing ACT or CST services by completing a notification of discontinuation of ACT or CST service form and faxing it to the collaborative. Discontinuation criteria are outlined in the service authorization protocol manual. Detailed information regarding discontinuance of ACT or CST services and linkage to other services must be documented in the consumer's clinical record. And the next screen shows an example of a notice of discontinuation for ACT. You can make sure that right under admit date to ACT, you put the discontinuation date and check all the criteria that apply. There's an example of a notice of discontinuation for CST. And again, these forms can be found on the Illinois Mental Health Collaborative website under Provider Manual. I'm going to turn it over to Brent now.
Okay. Thank you, Sue. I'm going to be going over the therapy counseling, the psychosocial rehab, and community support group methods of requesting authorization requests. And once again, you can find this on the Illinois Mental Health Collaborative website and the provider manual. Provider may submit a therapy counseling, CSG, or PSR authorization request using the following method, and that's going to the website. You can also choose to send in clinical documentation via fax to the 866-928-7177 number, although it must arrive within 24 hours of the submission or request. Requirements are that the collaborative staff will verify information for completeness, documents required based upon request time. The information in the request is consistent with information found in supporting documentation. If inconsistencies are provided or are found, the provider will be contacted regarding these inconsistencies. And this could be a difference in diagnoses, a GAF score, et cetera. If additional clinical information is required, the clinician will contact the provider to obtain clinical information via telephone, and the information will be documented in the review. Reviews submitted are really reviewed for the following three elements: completeness, adherence to Rule 132, adherence to medical needs criteria. And if the three elements are met for the services, the clinical care manager will enter an authorization. Continuing with requirements, if medical necessity is established, request is authorized by clinical care manager and communicated to provider in writing. If medical necessity is not established, the clinical care manager contacts provider to seek clarification, offer education, consultation regarding authorization criteria. An example where this might occur is if you have a locus score that does not meet medical criteria for that level of service, you did not provide a reason for deviation, we would contact you to get further clarification on that. If the collaborative and the provider reach mutual agreement in respect to the next steps, it will be submitted for review, alternate service will be considered, or if mutual agreement has not occurred and provider believes medical necessity is present, the clinical care manager will forward information to the collaborative physician advisor or PA reviewer. The PA reviews and either authorizes or denies the authorization. So getting started with the access or to start the authorization process is going to be much like it was for ACT or CST. You are going to go onto the website and log into Provider Connect. You can either access along the left-hand side of the screen, enter an authorization request, or in the center of the page. You do get the disclaimer. And just be advised that if you don't complete this process, the disclaimer will inform you that if you exit at any time before completing it, you will lose all that data. So you do need to stay on and complete it until you receive the notification that your request has been received by Value Options. Searching for a member, I think Leanne went over that, or that had been gone over at some point, but you do want to search for a member. Required fields include consumer ID or RIN number and the date of birth. You will then come to the member demographics and select next. Then you will come to provider location, and this is where you will select your agency address. Under the requested services header, this is when you will put in the requested start date, and please keep in mind you cannot backdate on these services. That's why it's very important that you keep track of the number of units that you have used, because it is necessary to give yourself a little bit of lead time before asking for an additional request. We go to the next page. It is really important for you to have a clinical staff for contact in case we have questions. If we don't know who to contact, we can't really get that additional clinical information. And then the diagnoses. It is imperative that all five diagnoses are addressed. If you have any like an access to, there's none, you can use the V71.09. Address the GAF score. LOCA score, typically for therapy counseling, we're looking for anything from 14 to 16. CSG is 17 to 19, and PSR is 20 to 22 or above. We don't really, that's the same for rest. If they fall below that, there needs to be a reason for deviation. And that's in that there is a narrative history, if we went back to the next sheet, that gives you up to 200 characters. The Ohio scale, if the locus, if the Ohio scale is used, you do not need to use the locust or locus. Required documents when you are supporting, requesting services would be the mental health system assessment and individual treatment plan. And then we get to services requested. And Leanne already went over the threshold, so I don't think we need to do that again. And so when you're submitting a request, in the narrative section, what we're really looking for are the reasons for requesting service, what symptoms or behavior is the consumer exhibiting, what progress is the consumer making toward the identified goals, what benefit has the consumer demonstrated from this service, and a description of discharge or transition plan. And what we're really looking for, not necessarily that they're ready for discharge at this time, but that you're really looking forward to what, as they progress in treatment, what will they be looking forward to being linked to or additional services that they might need. And we come to the determination status, which is like ACT and CST. You can have the options for printing or downloading the authorizations. That brings us to the administrative denial. And this is basically if you submit a request and the consumer does not have Medicaid, you will receive a call from the clinician that is processing your request for services, informing you that your request has been administratively denied due to not having Medicaid enrollment in our system. At that time, you will be instructed to resubmit the request with a Medicaid-eligible RIN. If the consumer is Medicaid-eligible and it is not reflected in our system, you will be asked to submit verification documents to show verification of Medicaid eligibility. Our clinical department will then forward this information to our eligibility department to be researched. If the determination is that they're eligible, the records will be updated in our system, allowing the auth request to be completed. You do have the option for a request for reconsideration and appeal. Prior to a denial, the collaborative staff will support consumers and providers by offering alternative services that can meet the consumer's needs in the least restrictive setting. Appeals can be requested by a provider on behalf of the consumer by calling the collaborative at 866-359-7953. The appeal must be received within 30 days of receipt of the denial. There are two levels of appeals. First is the internal physician advisor, otherwise called a PA. It's not the same PA who issued the original denial. It's not a subordinate of the original PA who issued the denial. And it is a PA who is licensed to practice in Illinois. External review by an independent reviewer. So those are the two levels. The third level of appeal is to DHS or DMH per established procedures. The DMH director's review, if the provider, consumer, or designated representative disagrees with the outcome of the reconsideration request, an appeal may be filed within 5 days of receipt of the outcome of the reconsideration request. This review shall not be a clinical review, but rather a review to ensure that all applicable appeal procedures have been correctly applied and followed. The final administrative decision shall be subject to judicial review exclusively as provided in the administrative review law. And that ends my portion. Trish, I'm going to turn it back to you.
Okay, thanks, Brett.
Sure, thank you.
Thank you. Now I'm going to turn the call over to Dr. Smith, who wanted to say a few words about claims.
Okay, thanks, Trish. Well, we're coming to the end, and we'll be ready to take your questions in a few minutes, but I thought it was worth spending 5 to 10 minutes about to discuss submission of claims. So if you already bill HFS, you're, I'm sure, familiar with the standard 5010 format that claims must be submitted on. But if you're not, that information is certainly posted on the HFS website. So all DMH claims are submitted directly to HFS. We made a change a couple of years ago, and so that's how claims are submitted. But again, as we said a couple of times during this presentation, HFS processes the claims using DMH business rules and information gathered through the enrollment process and also eligibility information. All HFS claims or DMH claims are submitted electronically using either the batch format, again, the standard 5010 format, or they may be submitted through the MEDI system. No paper claims. I doubt very much if folks are submitting paper claims, but there's certainly no submission for these services. And again, claims have to be submitted within 90 days of the service date due to the 180-day Timely Filing Act. If you want more information on that, if you go to the DHS-DMH website and go under the provider portal, you'll see on the right-hand side a list, and in that list there's a reference to communication alerts. If you look at the fiscal year 13 communication alert, there's a brief explanation of the 180-day billing edit, along with a link to the provider notice that's posted on the HFS website. You know, I would take this opportunity to also suggest that if you're not signed up for HFS provider notices, you do so that you can get those notices directly. I'm sure yesterday Kathy Cumpston, our Medicaid officer, talked about the service definition reimbursement guide. All of the services that are eligible to be billed are defined in the service definition guide. There's detailed definitions, their provider requirements, the modifiers that should be attached to the HCPCS codes, the appropriate HCPCS codes to use, location of services permitted by service, and then also the rates. Claims have to be submitted from valid sites, again, with valid HCPCS codes and modifiers. You know, again, this is why it's absolutely important to make sure all of your sites are enrolled and that the same information is on file with DMH and the collaborative as it is with HFS. If there's some mismatch, you know, for example, if we're showing a site as active on the collaborative DMH system and HFS has it as inactive, your claims will be rejected and you'll just have to resubmit them again. We do have a service matrix posted on the IllinoisMentalHealthCollaborative.com website. The service matrix gives you a view at a glance of the services for which you may bill for an individual that are Medicaid eligible. So it's really a nice little abbreviation of the service definition reimbursement guide. It shows you the HCPCS codes, the modifiers, the names of the service, the rates that are associated with different level of provider credentials, and then again there's a list under MCD that shows the codes that may be billed. If you go to the Illinois Mental Health Collaborative website, go through the provider portal, then on the left-hand side you'll see provider information. Click on that. That'll take you to another page with a lot of very useful information, including the presentations that were made today. But if you look under the claims finance heading, then you'll see the most recent service matrix that shows you, again, the services that are permissible to be billed for individuals that are Medicaid eligible. You will, you know, again, you're probably already familiar with this. If you're enrolled with HFS, you will receive remittance advice from HFS. There was a point in time when they were holding the remittance advice until a check was cut, but that's no longer true. And so you can get remittance advice from HFS fairly fast. You can also go in the MEDI system and look up individual claims to determine the outcome of processing for an individual claim. There are error codes that are listed in Chapter 100 that pertain to the remittance advices that you see. Chapter 100, of course, refers to the HFS list. And again, you can access that information by going to the HFS website under providers. The Collaborative and DMH, though, have also created an extensive set of on-demand reports, which are immensely helpful. In fact, you can the on-demand reports permit you to specify a range of things. You could look at service dates, specific codes, specific individuals, etc. And many providers run those reports, dump them into Excel spreadsheets, and then they use them to help troubleshoot the error reports that they receive. One thing that I would like to really emphasize, I think I forgot to do it when I was talking about the registration, it is imperative that you, when you submit a registration, as Trish said, check the results of the registration. You never, ever want to be in the position of submitting a registration and then waiting until a claim processes to find out if you have a registration error. We've given providers the tools so that they don't have to do that because you get immediate feedback as to whether a registration has been submitted. And, of course, if the registration has been submitted and accepted and it's successful, then your claims have a much higher likelihood of going through. In terms of billing issues, it's important, you know, address them immediately when you get the remittance advice or you run the on-demand reports that I've described that I guess we'll provide training on at another time, but those reports are available through Provider Connect. It's really important to try to figure out what the errors are. If you cannot do it, your first contact should be the HFS billing consultants. That information, the telephone number for the consultants really is posted, will be posted in the PowerPoint that Trish provided. That is the first place to start. DMH, the collaborative, and HFS meet every 2 weeks, and we review everything in detail. In the interim, however, if you talk to an HFS billing consultant and there's a billing issue, an email goes over to the collaborative and to DMH explaining what the problem is, and then these three entities work together to resolve any issues. So I can't emphasize enough, if you can't figure it out, start out with the HFS billing consultants. If it's a specific registration or authorization issue, there's a telephone number on the list, again, that Trish provided that will be posted that provides a telephone number for you to contact the appropriate person at the collaborative. So I think that is about it. If there, just one last point, I guess, if there's a policy question that you have, then you really need to contact your DMH regional contract manager. Dan Wasmer described regional services yesterday. If it's a policy issue, contact that contract manager. They, in turn, will make sure the information gets to the appropriate person so that we can address the issue. So with that, I think this is the end of our formal presentations. I'm going to turn this back over to Trish, and we'll see if there are any questions. Thank you.
Okay, and with that, Haley, we are ready to move into the Q&A portion of the call.
Thank you, ma'am. We will now begin the question and answer session. For those who would like to ask a question, you may dial star and then one, and you will be prompted to record your name. To cancel your question, you may dial star and then two. One moment, please, for the questions. We have a question coming from the line of Cleo Terry. Your line is open.
Thank you. Are any undocumented immigrants eligible for any of those additional education eligibility categories?
So in cases of crisis, you know, you can typically go ahead and do an assessment of the individual, you know, to determine the type of services they need and bill for that assessment.
Okay.
You know, it depends on what their needs are. They would be, you know, as Leanne, number one, you guys are billing Medicaid for services, and so if the individual's not Medicaid eligible, you're probably not going to see them, is my guess.
Even for a crisis service?
Well, even for a crisis service, because you don't, if they're not Medicaid eligible and you don't have a contract with DMH, there's no mechanism for you to bill.
Okay. All right. That clarifies. Thank you.
Yep.
Thank you, Ms. Terry. As of this moment, we don't have any questions on queue. So once again, for those who would like to ask a question, you may dial star and then one.
Well, Trish, if we don't have any questions, perhaps we can end on time.
Okay.
We still have one question on queue, ma'am.
Okay, go ahead.
The next question is coming from Nicole Milbrook. Your line is open.
Hi. Can you tell us how to become a contracted provider for non-Medicaid clients?
I would suggest that you contact the regional manager and discuss that.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
No more questions on queue, ma'am.
Well, okay, if there are no more questions in the queue, then we will go ahead and conclude our call for today. I would like to remind the audience that today's call audio and presentation will be posted under the Provider Resources heading on the Provider Information page of the collaborative website. The audio will be in MP3 format and ready for download within the next 2 or 3 business days. I would also like to remind everyone that we value your feedback, so please take a few minutes to complete the brief survey that will appear when you close out of the online forum today. Haley, please push the speakers through to post-conference, and you may now disconnect the main line.
Thank you, speakers, and that concludes today's conference. Thank you all for joining. You may now disconnect.